Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the debate on capitalism. But before that, a few of the other stories that have made the pages of the Times this week. Well, this week in 1923, that is. On Tuesday the 20th of March, there was a story about a chap called Charles Hattrey settling a libel action. Now, this may not sound particularly significant, but in a few years' time, Hattrey will, he'll go bust. He'll have a big business, it will go bust pretty spectacularly, partly because it involves, it involved forging the bonds of Wakefield Borough Council. This failure was often said to have been to sort of precipitated the Wall Street crash, obviously, of 1929. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. But the point was that he was remembered for this. Anyway, here he is a few years earlier, getting a mention in the Times. And I just wonder if maybe the people he sued for libel perhaps had a good case. Anyway, they crumbled. Interestingly enough, last week I mentioned that a certain story seems to have ended up in a novel, and this one too. The Agatha Christie story, King of Clubs, or at least the adaptation of that story, involves a character called Hawtrey, who is responsible for some financial shenanigans. So that's another example of this this genre. On Wednesday came the news that, you'll remember last week, it wasn't last week, it was a couple of episodes ago, February, the BBC were undermining British engineering by demanding that anyone who built a homemade radio receiver buy a license for it. And, well, they're at it again. This week they've been interfering with signals from the Air Ministry. Although not for long, because, the Air Ministry, that is the people who are in charge of the RAF, take precedence and tell the BBC to get lost and switch off their aerials and take them somewhere else. On Thursday, you may remember in real life, recently on the anniversary of the of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, someone decided to paint the road in front of the Russian embassy in blue and yellow. Well, in 1923, someone else is also painting stuff in blue and yellow. Not the road, just the precincts of University College. Turned out that it was the students of East London College were doing this. Now, there is no East London College nowadays. It got changed to Queen Mary College after, the current Queen Mary, as was Princess Mary of Teck, the wife of George V. Anyway, on Friday, there was an interesting story about Piggly Wiggly. Now, you may not be familiar with Piggly Wiggly, but it was an American company, and it's long since defunct, but it was the very first supermarket in that the customer had a basket, walked down an aisle, picked the products or groceries that he or she wanted to buy, and went to a checkout to pay for them. Now, the first store was opened in the south of the United States, not a part of the United States you tend to associate with cutting-edge developments, but anyway, that's where it started. And I can't remember the name of the guy, which is a shame, but it was opened in 1916, and, well, it's done very well. But someone has been shorting the stock. And what the proprietor, the owner of Piggly Wiggly has done, well, obviously I can't be the owner of everything because things are stock out, outstanding, but he has borrowed some money and organised, I can't remember the exact details of how these things are done, but he's organised a short squeeze. And Thursday's story tells us, no, sorry, Friday's story tells us that he's made a lot of money out of this, or he declares he's made a lot of money. Unfortunately, if you read Wikipedia, you get a different story. What actually happened, or is about to happen, is that the shorters, is that a word? Anyway, the people who are shorting his stock have gone and cried to the New York Stock Exchange and said, you know, we're all going to go bust. So the New York Stock Exchange has suspended, I think they suspended trading in Piggly Wiggly. Now, the consequences of this will be that they are able to pay him. He is not able to make any money out of this. In fact, and his creditors will come calling quite soon, with the result that he loses all control and all interest in Piggly Wiggly. Now, there may be more to this story. That's always a thing you've got to sort of bear in mind, but it doesn't sound fair, to say the least. Talking of things that are not fair, there is a promoter who has brought a bunch of Negro performers, as they were called. One word's black, but in those days they called them Negroes. And he wants to put them on the London stage. And, well, that is causing a big fuss, because the trade union for stage performers, objects. They say, this is wrong. Our members are often unemployed. There are 2,000 of us are out of work. We can't have these, I was going to say blacklegs. Well, these people taking our jobs. The promoter has said, well, hang on a minute, are you proposing to black up or something? We haven't got an answer to that. And we'll see how that one pans out. I don't know how many of you are big fans of Top Gear, but you may remember, this is about 20 years ago now, but they sawed off the roof of a Renault Espace and turned it into a convertible, and they solemnly declared that they were the first people ever to create a convertible people mover. Well, little did they know that 1923 was a bit ahead of them in that respect. In those days, a double-decker bus, the top would be open to the elements. I really do dread to think what would happen if it had been raining and you went up there and you sat down. But anyway, that was how it was. I did see a report. This was before the First World War, in which bus companies were trying to find an answer. I mean, you would have thought the answer was to put a roof on the top. But they did say, I mean, one of them said, I mean, well, it would have been the London General Omnibus Company. And it did say, oh, we can't do that. It is absolutely impossible. But in 1923, they have a solution. And you've probably guessed it. They turned it into a convertible. Yes, you have it's most of the time it's top down. But if it starts to rain, there is a convertible roof that can be cover the top of the bus. On Friday, there was a slightly less enjoyable story. There was a story about sleepy sickness, or what's known as sleepy sickness, and the fact that there've been a few more cases of this. This is a disease that's almost entirely forgotten about, and it's a very odd one. It would strike people. Small numbers of people, never great numbers. I think it's about 500,000 in total. And would, in many cases, in some cases, kill them, but in many cases, reduce them to statues. Just put them to sleep for years. Some would die, as I said. Some would recover to some extent, but very few would make a full recovery. I'll say it again. Recovery from it. But it's still a mystery. It's still a mystery as to what this was. Anyway. Oh, hang about, I forgot something. I was going to mention actually the big stories of this week. They are that The Turks have come back to talks about a peace treaty, and it looks awfully like they're going to sign what they were. They walked out in, I think it was January, and from the talks in Lausanne, and I think it looks like they're just going to, after a huff, they've come back and decided, well, actually, we may as well agree to this. The big issue of contention was the future of Mosul, and considering that, to the best of my knowledge, Mosul has not at any point in the last 100 years been under control of Turkey, it looks awfully like they're going to have to, accept they've lost that. And the other news that was took up some space in the pages of the Times was there has been an inquiry about the governance of London. Now, at the moment, we have effectively one council for what's known as Greater London, which has 32 boroughs and is headed by a mayor. Now, in 1923, there was a London County Council, but that was a much, much smaller area. And it also had a sort of smorgasbord. That's a better word for that. It's a better word for that. I can't remember. Anyway, a sort of mixture of county boroughs and metropolitan boroughs and other boroughs governing other parts of London. Plus, they had poor law boards, which were an entirely separate part of government, elected entirely separately to look after the poor. Anyway, there's been an inquiry into what the future should be. We all know what the future eventually was going to be, the creation of Greater London, I think sometime after the Second World War. I'm far from convinced that was a good thing, but the report manages to have a majority report and two minority reports. So obviously the commission had a wide range of opinion. Anyway, it looks as if very little happened in the short term. Now, on to the main story. On Wednesday, the 21st, the House of Commons had a debate on capitalism. This would, I presume, I mean, in these days in Parliament, there are such things as known as supply days, in which the, I think it is supply days, isn't it? Well, the opposition days. Anyway, they are days in which the opposition can choose the subject of debate. Wednesday, it's actually the Tuesday when this occurred, usually the 20th of March. Philip Snowden, who would later become the Chancellor of the Exchequer, he had this to say. This is the title of the motion. That in view of the failure of the capitalist system to adequately utilise and organise natural resources and productive power, or to provide the necessary standard of life for vast numbers of the population, and believing that the cause of this failure lies in the private ownership and control of the means of production and distribution, this House declares that legislative effort should be directed to the gradual supersession of the capitalist system by an industrial and social order based on the public ownership and democratic control of the instruments of production and distribution. Well, it's nothing if not bold. He goes on. Well, actually didn't go on. This is the report goes on. He desired at the outset to say that he was always ready to give to those who differed from them equal credit for their honesty and their sympathy with the condition of a large part of the population. They differed, and he would proceed on that assumption in what he had to say as to the best means by which industrial conditions could be improved and social amelioration attained. Kind words across the chamber. Don't often get that these days. It went on. They had today, in spite of the possibilities of wealth, a very large mass of people working hard under unhealthy conditions and at low wages, and a very considerable part of those who would work unable to work, while at the other end of that social scale they had people so rich that even imagination could not devise means for spending their superabundant wealth. Something that Scott Adams, he of the Dilbert comic, also once said, I think it was in his success book, that when you get to about £2 billion or $2 billion, whatever it was, actually it's rather difficult to spend the money. although I confess I accept that's not really what Snowden's getting at here. He goes on. The capitalist system had assumed the functioning of managing industry. It had failed to do that adequately or efficiently. How could anyone defend a system which was unable to find employment for 1.5 million would-be workers? I think the actual figure at the moment is 1.3 million, not that that is, makes much difference. Although how capitalist Britain is in 1923 is another question. I think it is worth pointing out that before the First World War, when Britain was much more capitalist than it is now, with much less regulation and taxation, there was virtually no unemployment at all. In fact, to the extent that the word unemployment or unemployed very rarely got used in the Times. They might talk about idleness, but not unemployed. Anyway, he goes on. There was no sphere in which the capitalist system had more lamentably failed than in providing what was the crying necessity of the people, housing accommodation. Well, this demonstrates a certain amount of chutzpah, you'd have to say. What was it? Chutzpah, I don't know. At the moment, rents are controlled. It was a wartime measure, which has persisted well beyond the end of the war. And what does that do? Well, it means that people don't want to rent out their houses because they don't get enough money for it. It's not a profitable activity. Why buy or build property for rent when you're not going to get much money for it? So it's no great surprise. But he's blaming capitalism for this. Anyway, he goes on. All the great inventions that were the basis of our present machinery were discovered when men lived together in tribes. The capitalist system would pass away, and was passing away, before the eyes of every one of sufficient intelligence to read the signs of the times. A ministerialist, then why worry? Well, indeed, that's sort of Karl Marx's argument that socialism would spontaneously appear. But I find that an extraordinary statement, this idea that all the developments were discovered when we lived in tribes. This seems a complete inversion of the truth. And for someone of Snowden's age, it wouldn't be ancient history exactly. He would know perfectly well of the extraordinary number of developments that had occurred in his lifetime. Things like the internal combustion engine a wireless communication and probably 100 other things, and certainly the growth in the use of electricity. So it's a very odd remark for him to be making. The reply came from Sir Alfred Mond. Now, he's a rather interesting character. His father had set up a company called Brunner-Mond, which was a chemical company, and appears to have done very well in the war. It's a very simple reason for this is that before the war, it was Germany who were the leaders in chemicals, and well, after when the war started, Britain effectively had to create a new chemical industry. So anyone who was around at the time would have done very well. Brunner-Mond, it's a name that's disappeared because it was folded into the Imperial Chemical Industries Company in, I think, 1926, or ICI. Now, if you're my age, you'll be perfectly familiar with ICI because it was a very big company. It's probably, I believe, the biggest company by market capitalization in Britain in the 1980s. It no longer exists. I think it got broken up at some point shortly after, so it's been forgotten about. Mond himself will become, in 1929, Lord Melchett. Yes, I say yes, it all depends if you're familiar with the Blackadder stories, of course, in Blackadders 2, 3 and 4. Lord Melchett is a very important... Oh, no, well, it's 2 and 4, actually. I don't think he appears in 3. 2 and 4. He's a very important character, and he's very much an aristocrat, one of the hereditary peerage. Now, it is certainly true that Lord Melchett was a hereditary peer, but a very, very new one. Ironically. Well, of course, if you have to say it's ironic, it isn't really ironic. Oh, well. Anyway, I think it's interesting. Anyway, this is what he has to say, or what the Times said he said. It was extremely easy to blame the capitalist system for ill health, insufficient life, feebleness of constitution, inequality of human ability, but would honourable members tell the House whether under socialism there would be any syphilitic children, whether there would be any drunkards in the world, or any offspring of drunkards? Did he think that under any system which might be adopted, he could produce equality of ability, equality of efficiency, and equality of physical and mental standards and prospects, for the failure to produce which he attacked not the capitalist but the industrial system? He went on. The wealthy men were not those who had been idle all their lives, but the men who started with very little, and who by hard work, enormous energy, and foresight had built up great industries. He had given a great deal of thought to this subject, and he did not believe it was possible to organise industries on a national basis which would give higher efficiency. You're not kidding. What honourable members had to prove was that they could manage all these enterprises very much better than people in other countries like Germany, France and Italy had been able to do. Honourable members had been very theoretical, but at bottom they were unpractical. You're kidding. He goes on. Paralysis seemed to seize everybody as soon as they began to work for the state or for a municipal or for a municipality. That was because everybody had a cushy job. No. There was no profit and loss account, and it was supposed not to matter how the money was spent. On the other hand, the capitalist had a method by which inefficiency was wiped out and efficiency was rewarded. Private employers who could not make a profit out of business had to go under and make way for people who could. That's almost precisely the argument that Ludwig von Mises made in Socialism, which was published in 1920, or published in German in 1920. Whether Mond would have been aware of this by now, I doubt, but it's exactly the same argument. Although, of course, von Mises takes 500 pages to make it. It goes on, in response to a Labour heckle, a cooperative society was one of the finest capitalist things in the world. It was owned by a large number of small capitalists. I think I'll add my own hear to that quite. For the government, a Sir P. Lloyd, says Graham here, I think it's Graham, said this. Socialism, under whatever guise they might dress it, might be a very effective way to make rich men poor, but it was a singularly ineffective way of making poor men richer. Quite. Anyway, that's all for this week. I hope to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.